Welcome to the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. My name is Lauren Wells, here with my co-host, Chris Seveny. We're committed to providing you with the knowledge required to build wealth through real estate investing. Tired of consuming content about real estate? Stuck in analysis paralysis? Ready to do your first deal? As a member of our community, you will learn how to go from consuming content to taking that first step into the world of real estate investing. Our show is not about getting rich quick, but about providing you with the knowledge you need to take action. Join us as we speak with experienced investors who share action tips on how to escape the corporate world, start a thriving side hustle in the world of real estate, and go beyond your W-2 or 401k.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. I'm your co-host, Chris Seveny. And today we have a special guest. We have Sterling Chapman from Crestworth Capital. Sterling, how are you today?
Doing good, Chris. Thank you so much for having me.
No problem. So Sterling's been in real estate for a little over 5 years. Went to LSU, got a bachelor's in finance, an MBA, worked a W-2 job, which he's still working to this date and so forth, but has been able to build a very impressive real estate portfolio. So today we're going to talk about him building that portfolio, how he's built it, how he's raised money, because that's something people are always interested in, and go through some of the lessons learned over the last 5 years. So Sterling, again, thanks for having us. And mind just sharing with us today what your portfolio looks like?
Sure. So today, if we did a snapshot of what it looks like, this, because it's always changing, I have around 80 single family rental properties. I say single family, they're not all single family. I have about 50 single family rental properties. And then the rest of those 80 are like duplexes and fourplexes. So 1 to 4 units in my local backyard market is 80 rental properties. Mm-hmm. We're currently in process on 10 different houses that we're flipping. We have 3 under contract to sell, 3 under contract to buy in renovation process. We have 5 apartment syndications that we're general partners on. 3 of them are smaller projects. One's a 54, one's a 45, and one's a 70. And I'm very actively involved in all of the management and decisions on those projects. And then I've worked with a little bit looser affiliation on some much larger projects with some much bigger groups, where I focused a lot on capital raising and marketing and stuff like that. So we're also in the process now of taking our property management company, taking on other people's properties to manage. That's a big focus of our office this month.
You started in 2018, is that correct?
Yeah, it's so funny because you asked the story backwards. I've told the story on 100 podcasts and I always do it in chronological order. You mess me up. You're like, all right, where are you today? Now let's work backwards.
Yeah. Well, I like to start with where you're at today and then dive into like in 5 years, you've built this portfolio. So now I'm like intrigued and people are intrigued, like, wow, how did you do all of this in 5 years? Because you're flipping, starting a management company, you've managed assets. How did you do it? And what's your team look like? And I'm just, you know, so now let's pull back to start with, like, how'd you start?
Yeah. So I'll tell the story in normal chronological order now. So moving up really fast and in this telecom company was, that was my whole goal in life, was to be like big corporate guy, a CFO or whatever. As a kid, my dad was a vice president at some big company and he wore suits to work every day and he traveled. And that's just what I visualized success to look like and romanticized the life I wanted. And I was moving up really fast and that was the life I had. And a few different things happened around the end of 2017 and the beginning of 2018 that kind of changed my trajectory. So I'd gotten promoted. So I was making over 6 figures for the first time in my life. And I was like, I went to my dad all excited. Hey, I'm making over 6 figures. He was like, great. You need to like go read some personal finance books. He goes, I know a lot of people that have made a lot of money and ended up broke and they look dumber than the guys who never made any money. And so I started with Dave Ramsey. I went to my girlfriend, who's my wife. She was my girlfriend at the time. She's my wife. And I was like, all right, we're never going to have any debt. We're never going to have any credit cards, blah, blah. She's like, okay, whatever. And the next week I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad. I was like, scratch that. We're going to get as much debt as we can. She's like, okay, whatever. Like, just leave me alone. Like, and so Rich Dad, Poor Dad, I ended up reading a bunch of Rich Dad, Poor Dad advisor books, Tom Realwright's tax book, Garrett Sutton's law book, and all that kind of stuff. Fumbled on the bigger pockets. I was training for triathlon. So I was always on the road, biking or running. So I listened to every Bigger Pockets episode, listened to all their audio books. And in the summer of 2018, so that was, I read Rich Dad Poor Dad in February of 2018. So by the summer, I'd started buying a couple of rental properties. In that same time period, my boss had gotten surplus around the end of 2017. I thought that he had been with the company for 15 years, winning award trips, going on accolades, and they had a down quarter. And they just, oh, now you don't have a job anymore. I'd also was doing my MBA, taking an entrepreneurship class. And I'd love to be in charge, do something on my own. And so all of that kind of was going on at the same time. And that was when I decided I needed some kind of secondary income to save me. I just had this terrible vision of being 40, being in my 40s with like three kids in private school, because in South Louisiana, you have to send your kids to private school because it's too dangerous in public school. Car notes, home mortgage. And I'd given 80 hours of my week every week for all these years, and they just surplus me. Like, that's the stuff they make movies about. And I just didn't want to give that much control to anybody else. I was like, I need backup income. I spent every penny I had saving up down payments for those first two rental properties in the summer of 2018. And I was out of money. And I was like, all right, well, it's going to take me another 2 years to save up for another two rental properties. And then I discovered like more creative strategies. We started doing seller finance deals. We started doing burr houses. I'd borrow money, buy a distressed house, fix it up, do a cash out refinance with the bank, put a tenant in it. And so that was how I built up that single family portfolio, was recycling the same cash over and over and over again. And through that story, at some point, that was what 2018 and 2019 and 2020 looked like. And then we bought our first apartment syndication in February of 2021. Then we bought another one in February of 2022. Then we did another three throughout 2022. Also, at the beginning of 2022, I realized I had all these construction workers who had been doing nothing but my project. They'd worked purely for me for years at this point. And I was getting this deal flow, because we had started my podcast years before. We'd started a meetup. So everybody in town knows that I do these deals. I'm very public on social media with it. So I was getting deal flow, and I had people doing construction work. And I was like, well, why don't I start flipping too? Because I was building out this infrastructure. I was investing in people. I was investing in marketing. I was investing in systems and processes. And the extra cash from the flips helped build out that infrastructure, because the payouts from the apartment complexes are a half a decade removed a lot of times. Yeah. So what we look like today, we have about 23 field guys that do all of our construction, working on our 10 flips. In the office, I currently have a property manager, I have a project manager, I have a marketing director, and we're in the process of hiring an office manager / assistant property manager. We were supposed to have one start on Monday, but she no-showed. So now we're kind of back to the interview process.
That's a great summary. And now I've got several things I've been writing down here to peel back on this, because I'm intrigued and curious on several things. You mentioned kind of the seller finance route, because capital is always sometimes challenging. Many people aren't outgoing, and usually a lot of people who are number crunchers and so forth aren't the best at the presentation skills, or, you know, I'm an engineer. So, you know, we joke with my partner, Lauren, it's like, okay, I crunch the numbers, let me hang out in my basement and you do your thing. And she's great at sales and investor relations. On that seller financing front, were these deals that were like on MLS that just had it, or were these off-market deals? How did you approach and find these seller financing deals?
I got a lot of seller financing deals from the same individuals. He had, I think, a duplex or a fourplex listed on MLS. Mm-hmm. So I reached out to him. He had a little like comment in the listing, like, you know, we'll consider seller finance. I called him and I was like, let's go to lunch and talk. So I went and lunched and I said, look, I don't want that building because it's in a terrible area. But if you have other ones, and it turned out he had like 30 or 40 other ones in areas I did want. And he didn't want the cash for him because he was 75 years old and he had been 1031-ing these properties for 40 years. They'd been deferred all this capital gains and all this taxes for 40 years. And if I'd have turned around and paid him outright cash, like a normal transaction, he would have a huge tax liability. What we did was we worked out this model where it was a small down payment. And really all he wanted was income for his retirement. He didn't, you know what I mean? The first couple of deals we did like 10% down. He did seller finance and the rest. The next few deals, I think he did a few at 5% down, a few at 0%. It was good for me at the time for the way I was trying to build my business, because I had just kind of a bigger vision about going into multifamily and raising capital and stuff. So for me, like early on, it was almost like a marketing game where I wanted to like ramp up the number of doors I had and my credibility and that kind of stuff. So I bought all this stuff. As it turns out, financially, it wasn't a great decision. You know, if you just look at it in that vacuum, because if somebody's willing to sell or finance it, you know, that kind of stuff, typically what I've found, my experience is they want more than if it's a normal outright sale. You're paying a premium for the seller financing. With most of these properties, they were really, really in bad shape. And I spent hundreds of thousands of dollars fixing them up over the last couple of years. So like it worked out for me in that they did their job early on and gave me enough credibility to build off of. But financially, if you look at those actual assets and like how it really shook out about like how much money I poured into them versus how much money I got out, like probably wasn't that great of an investment.
You've got the deal flow. Now, are you primarily staying in one market in your area right now with most of your properties and so forth? Or have you broadened your portfolio?
So we approach markets more intentionally than we approach individual properties, I feel like sometimes. I don't buy large multifamily properties in where I live in South Louisiana for a number of reasons. So if you've studied any type of market research data, you know that like Louisiana, Mississippi are like the worst places on earth. When you're buying multi-million dollar asset, with especially with other people's money, you want to be very intentional about setting yourself up for success, right? And putting yourself in the line of growth. So you look for markets where you've got job growth. You look for markets where you've got population growth. Like people are moving there. They're creating jobs there. There's job diversity, right? You don't want to be in Michigan before the auto industry goes overseas. You don't want to be in Lafayette, Louisiana when oil goes bust. Like you don't want these markets that are overly dependent on one industry or one company, because that could devastate the local economy and cause your vacancy to skyrocket overnight. And then we look at crime, we look at poverty, we look at supply and demand. And so if you go down the gauntlet of all of the things you want to look for in a decent market, we don't check any of those boxes. So I won't buy an apartment complex in Baton Rouge. That being said, I've got $8 million worth of single family houses and duplexes and fourplexes because A, it's all my money, right? And B, it's my backyard, so I know it really well. And so I think people can make money in any market. You know what I mean? You're just going to pay a premium for a highly demanded market versus a lower. I just think this is a lower market where I can manage flipping houses and making money in this market because it's a short time window. I can manage rentals in this market because I just analyze the numbers. I just buy low and fixed rate debt. But a five-year business plan on a $10 million asset, like give me Atlanta, Georgia, give me Houston, Texas, give me Charlotte, North Carolina. And so to answer your original question, that's where our multifamily assets are. So we've got a 54 unit in Noonan, Georgia, which is basically Atlanta, right? It's 28 minutes from the Atlanta airport. We've got a 70 unit in Rock Hill, South Carolina, which is essentially Charlotte. It's 33 minutes from the Charlotte airport. We've got a 45 unit in Hampton, Virginia, where there's a lot of government infrastructure. That economy's not going anywhere anytime soon. Yep. And then we've got two deals in Houston. And you know, Houston is diverse and big and all those things. And Atlanta.
Like you mentioned, your local area with some of the single families and so forth. You know, it's also diversity in numbers. It's not like you mentioned, it's not one building with 50 units that everything is relied on that one building in that one market at one area that could have, you know, new development or basically something happen in that area. If you're spread throughout an area, like anybody, everybody wants to diversify that portfolio. So that's always a benefit. And even the fact that like your multifamily properties, you know, you're in, like you said, Georgia, South Carolina, North Carolina, and Texas, you've done your research because if you look at any map, where are people moving to now? People are moving, I'll say, from the upper corners of the United States and, you know, making that V, either coming down the East Coast or over to Texas. You're seeing a lot of people move. So it's areas that are diverse and have that population growth. So for people looking to build a market, and you see that on Bigger Pockets a lot, where should I invest? Well, you can invest anywhere, but typically, like you mentioned, you want to invest in an area where there's population, job growth, and they're not all on one market.
So on top of all of those things I listed, the most important one that I didn't list is basically, and I don't want to get into a political conversation, but the local politics, right? Like you can't do it in New York City or San Francisco because they have rent control, because they have insane permitting. They have these restrictions. Money goes where it's treated the best. That's why people are flooding to Florida and Georgia in Texas because of the tax situation. Like, you go to markets, like I said, San Francisco and New York, you're going to have, it's going to take you 9 months to evict somebody. You know how hard it is to run a successful rental business when people can live on your property for a year for free? Like, you have insane taxes on the money you do make. And then you have rent control. So like it just breaks the entire business model when you go to those markets.
We hope you're enjoying this episode of Creating Wealth Simplified. We wanted to take a moment and tell you more about our passive income fund at 7E, which is open to both accredited and non-accredited investors. Our latest offering targets an 8% annual return distributed monthly, with the ability to potentially achieve a greater return through our bonus share program. If you'd like more information, reach out to us at invest@70investments.com to learn more. Thank you. I've been on a planning board before in a small town and everything. I worked for commercial developers in the past, commercial contractors. One thing people I don't think understand behind the scenes is simple things like in certain jurisdictions, getting a permit. If they don't know who you are, it is going to take a lot longer to get that permit than if you were a developer in that area that has done 10 deals or you know somebody locally. So that's one thing for anybody kind of on the development side is like, oh, I want to go develop a property in this area. I always tell people team up with somebody in the area and make sure you've got an architect, engineer, and staff that is basically, I'll say, golf buddies with people who are on the department. So they already know what to look for. So why don't I kind of move a little bit? You know, because you've been able to grow that portfolio, you've done the seller financing, you've also been able to successfully raise capital, correct?
We've raised a little over $4 million in the last 2 years.
Now, has that been friends and family? I think you mentioned prior, you do a 506B, so you got to be careful, can't advertise things like that because of working with non-accredited investors and so forth. But typically, I think you mentioned you've done some 506Bs. I'm guessing mostly people that are kind of in your circle or people you've known for a while.
Yeah, so it starts close and then it creeps out quickly. Like we had mentioned before, I've done 3 506Bs and 2 506Cs. I like the Bs better. I wanted to try the C because I'm like, well, if I can advertise, I can reach all these people. But the fact of the matter is, like, it doesn't matter how much you advertise. Like, nobody's really going to invest with you unless they have some type of trust connection. Yep. Has been my experience. So like, earlier, we talked about Annie's program with Good Egg and all of their marketing content and systems, which has been great. But all of my investors, I want to say almost all of my investors are a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend. I bought all of those systems and processes and implemented it. And we do the drip campaigns and the lead magnets and all of this stuff. But I don't know that we've ever had a cold conversion. What it does is when my brother's friends, cousin's neighbor is referred to me, they go check out my website, they download my ebook, they get the drip campaign, they see that I have a podcast, right? They probably don't listen to it, but they see I've interviewed 170 investors. And they're like, oh, this guy seems pretty legit. He's got sharp looking marketing. He's interviewed all these investors. You know what I mean? So all of this extra stuff that we do, I assume there's other people who have been fruitful in pumping cold investors through the machine. I personally haven't been, but the machine has been very helpful to warm up the referral business I get, because that's really where it boils down to. And I don't even know how many steps, like this is 7 degrees to Kevin Bacon or whatever. Yeah. I don't even know how many degrees of separation I'm at yet, but I want to say I counted to like 9 the other day.
Oh,
like my cousin referred me to his friend. She referred me to her friend who referred me to his friend who referred me to their father-in-law who referred me to some friends of his father-in-law. That's 6 degrees on the last investor.
For us getting started, we started a podcast, I think it was 2018, and that probably had the highest ROI out of any marketing effort that we had with podcasting. I'm sure you're very similar. You just share with people like the ebook and tell them what you do. I never would say people, oh, come invest with me or this and that. We'd have people who are interested in them. Of course, we'd give them deals and show them deals to get them invest. But by showing you're an expert in something or, you know, talking about it and sharing your stories, people are intrigued, especially real estate, because everybody loves real estate. it's something that people are interested in. You've got the Rent Real radio show and your Red Stick RIA and stuff. So I'm guessing, like you mentioned, that podcast, even if people listen to one or two episodes, you know, it's one of those things where it adds credibility for the good and for the bad, because there's also people out there who have podcasts and have great marketing campaigns, but you also got to sometimes peel back the onion on some people because there's been some bad actors, unfortunately.
I've always said about the podcast, I don't care if anybody listens to it. Now, I mean, it's not true, obviously. Like, I check to see how many people listen to it. We get a lot, but like in reality, like I shouldn't care if anybody listens, because the true value to me is, like you said, being established as a thought leader in the industry. Mm-hmm. And like, whether people listen to my show or not, they still know I do it and they still consider me a thought leader, right? You did not learn something by spending 170 hours interviewing 170 multimillionaire real estate investors. You know what I mean? So there's that. And then there's just the forced education and the forced networking. Like the relationships I've built from the guests on my show and the things I've learned from them on a consistent basis, like it forces me to do the right behaviors, because I can get bogged down in work, right? And like in writing website copy or doing this or doing that, not be intentional about networking or not be intentional about learning something new. I mean, I could look up and months have gone by, but with the podcast forced me to do every week, I'm meeting somebody new, I'm spending an hour with them and I'm learning something new.
Exactly. And it drives me nuts sometimes because I've got two kids. One's a freshman in college and the other one's in middle school and stuff. And, you know, they're on YouTube and Mr. Beast and all this stuff. And they're watching some of these things. And you see like these certain videos for entertainment purposes, getting like a million views, like right off the bat. And it's like, we talk about in your podcast, my podcast, like we're giving people blueprints, how to literally go make money, whether passively or actively.
And they don't want it.
Yeah, nobody wants it. Nobody wants to learn anything. And then it's like all of a sudden, like you mentioned, you get to 45 years old and be like, oh my God, how am I going to retire? And then you go back and you might start getting in real estate. And then you look back and like, wow, I wish I got invested this in 25 years old. Part of our team, we have a woman in our investor relations department who just graduated college last year. And we have another intern who's graduating this year. And they're basically digesting a lot of this information. And it's just like mind blowing for them. Like her name's Tony, when she started with us, like a 401k and like, okay, should she go Roth or regular, and explaining like a lot of the ins and outs in that. And she's like, oh my God, listening to podcasts. Cause she's like, nobody teaches you this. There's no college courses. Maybe there isn't some finance and so forth, but I didn't realize till I was, I don't even know, probably close to in my mid 30s or 40s, that when I would switch a company, like, oh, I could actually move it to a self-directed IRA, where they basically, my Fidelity in was saying, oh, you can move it to your new company or keep it here. Well, of course, nobody tells you. Oh yeah, you can do this as well. Very interesting with the podcast. And like you mentioned, you do it, people listen, great, but there's so much valuable content. But just by meeting so many people on the podcast and hearing what other people do, it gives you ideas and out there for people to find their niche and what they want to do. For me, I view your growth to be substantial growth over the last 5 years, from starting, you know, from zero to 60, proverbially, has gone really well for you. What are some of the things that you've seen have been instrumental that you've learned, and also maybe share like something that wish you may have done a little bit differently?
So for me, what I've found the most instrumental part of this business is the networking and the people. So there's a ton of content that you can consume at home, your podcast, my podcast, books, YouTube, you can learn it all, but you're not going to really get anywhere until you meet people, right? You need sellers, you need buyers, you need construction workers, you need employees, you need investors, you need all those different pieces. If people ask me all the time, like, well, where do you get your deals? I'm like, they just show up in my inbox. people just send them to me. Like, well, how do you get people to send them to you? Like, I've just been fanatically networking for 5 years and telling everybody I meet what I want, and intentionally going to look for the people that are finding what I'm looking for.
Yeah, that was basically what's been instrumental with it. To add to that, similar to us, like we do note investing, which is very niche. There's not a lot of people out there, but just constantly going to conference and meeting people. And then there was a larger player recently where we've had some growth and we reach out to them. And now we meet their, I'll call it investment capital requirements, where we previously couldn't. Now, all of a sudden, our deal flow just from this one client has probably increased our deal flow by like 10 or 20% just because you've hit some that threshold. And that's all due because of the marketing and the relationships we've been building over the last several years.
Absolutely.
So is there one thing, if you went back, would there be anything that you would change that you've done?
I don't know. I mean, I've certainly made a lot of mistakes. I've certainly had a lot of headaches along the way. I mean, it's hard to say, like, would you turn back time and change it if you learned something from it? Whenever I ask that question, feedback I get a lot is everybody goes, I would have gone bigger sooner. I would have gone bigger. I don't know that that's necessarily the answer for me. I like my dual single family, multifamily approach. I know a lot of other people look down on it, but it works well for us. I don't know what we would have done differently. Probably would have bought more when interest rates were low because they can't hold much.
Everybody wishes they did that. So with the company and its growth, you know, do you see yourself continuing to grow like in 3 years? You know, if you were to paint a picture of where it is in 3 years, do you see yourself in new markets? Do you see yourself growing? I know you've got the management side of things that you're actively growing as well. Just do you have some future vision or something, that one thing that, okay, in like 3 years, I want to be doing like a new development deal or anything along those lines?
We're very intentional about goal setting and stuff around here. So our 10-year, like, big, hairy, audacious goal is we want to own and manage $1 billion in real estate. 3 years from now, you know, our big three for 3 years from now are going to be, we want to manage 5,000 units across 4 markets. We want to have $200 million in assets under management. And then the other goal is just the amount of equity we'll have in the company. So we've been on track on Gino Wickman's entrepreneurial operating system for a while. And then a couple months ago, I went to the Best Ever Conference, Jeff Ehrlich's Steel, which I go to every year. And I met Don Winter with DLP Capital. And so I got his book, Building an Elite Organization, at the reference of my friend Whitney Sewell, who I've got a tremendous amount of respect
for. I know Whitney,
who advised me to do that. And so after reading Building an Elite Organization 3 times in the last, we're tweaking some of the things we do with Traction. And I think that's all he really did, right, is just kind of tweak the EOS model and incorporate a lot of Jim Collins stuff and elite execution stuff. So I just kind of like that more robust approach. And I just like the relative EOS is white label, right? Like, it's for a dental company. It's for a haircutting company. It's for a real estate company. It's for, whereas Don's process is really tailored towards like a real estate investment firm, a vertically integrated real estate investment firm that has property management and construction and assets under management, raises capital. And it just feels like it fits more like a glove for where we're at and where we're going.
Typically, I like to ask, there's a book or so forth, Building an Elite Organization seems like it's something you absolutely recommend for somebody.
Yeah, so it is at this point in my journey. But for somebody who's maybe newer to a lot of it, one of the most transformational books for me was Joe Fairless's Best Ever Apartment Syndication book. There was a few like complete paradigm shift books that like, you know, like when I read Rich Dad, Poor Dad, I was like, oh my God, I don't need to work for people. And then when I read Brandon Turner's book on buying rental property investing, I was like, oh, I need to own a bunch of rental properties. Yeah. And then when I read Joe Fairless's book, it was just the third big paradigm shift. It was like, oh, I need to go buy apartment complexes. I really like that.
When you started the conversation saying you listened to Dave Ramsey, I was thinking, where is this one going to be going? Because the opposite about that. The interesting thing, though, I know a lot of real estate investors have their opinions on Dave. TikTok came up the other day of him interviewing a woman and husband who had $1 million of debt, and it was like $300,000 in student loans, a $250,000 mortgage, like 50 in car loans. And then it's like $400,000 in credit cards and unsecured debt. And I was just like, oh my God. But for people who always, I want to use the term knock him a little bit about debt, he's catered or focused the people who don't know how to manage money. So real estate investors typically are managing money. And so,
yeah, I mean, he's got his spot. He's got this one quote that I love, and it's, don't spend money you don't have to buy things you don't need to impress people you don't like. That's gold. I love that. But I know who he's catering to. And there are people that need his help. And there are people that are truly need to be told not to go to Disney 3 times this year if you can't make your car payment.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? Like, it's not us, but there are those people that need that.
Thanks for coming on this episode and so forth. If people want to reach out, learn more, what's the best way for them to reach out to you?
My email is sterling@crestworthcapital.com. I'm on Facebook, Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, all of that kind of stuff. You can go to crestworthcapital.com, our website, download our ebook, message me on Facebook or Instagram. I mean, we're easy to find.
And all that information, of course, will be in the show notes. And also, you can listen to Sterling's podcast. He's a host of the Rent Roll radio show. So thank you, everyone, for listening. Thank you, Sterling, for coming on today. And if you have not already, please like and subscribe to our podcast on your favorite listening station. Thank you all.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Chris.
Thank you for joining Lauren and I on this episode of the Creating Wealth Simplified podcast. Each week, we bring you expert education, experience, and information in a digestible format to help you identify investment opportunities so you can build wealth through real estate and take action toward your financial goals. Enjoy the show, share with a friend, or subscribe to the show and leave us a review.